This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Our first guest, Matei Georgescu, explains new science showing cities distort the natural cycles of drought and rain. Expect to hear about record floods again and again, with no word from the weather reporters about why this is happening. We know unbearable heat and floods are coming to cities around the world, but everyone will act surprised as it happens. Setting records used to be a good thing. It was about progress. In these times of a shifting climate, extreme weather records become the normal signposts on the way to a different climate. Keep low, stay well, stay informed. This is Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Large wildfires can generate their own weather systems. Can megacities change their local climate? We know cities get hotter than the surrounding countryside. A new study shows urban flooding will increase too. We get the scoop on tomorrow's headlines from the lead author, Dr. Matei Georgescu. He is associate professor in the School of Geographical Sciences and Urban Planning at Arizona State University. Matei, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
From your first degree to your doctorate from Rutgers, you've been studying relationships between cities and climate change. What kindled this special interest in you?
It was actually quite personal, to be honest. I used to live in New Jersey with my parents. I went to school at Rutgers. My parents moved to Arizona. I came to visit them one holiday season. At the time, in the early 2000s, they were living on the outskirts of the urban area. I came to visit them again one year later. They were no longer living on the outskirts. The metropolitan area had engulfed them in the northwestern part of the city. And so I started to ask the obvious. What are the implications of this really rapid and extensive urban growth? And from them moving to this area, my PhD dissertation was born.
And southern Arizona is really a desert environment, so why are you studying urban flooding?
I'm studying urban impact in general, not necessarily urban flooding alone. So cities can really impact their regional environment in a myriad of ways. Most of the focus has been on temperature, but we know from earlier observational studies going back into the 1970s and afterwards that cities can also affect precipitation as well. Precipitation is really a difficult thing to simulate properly using state-of-the-art climate models. But we have this wealth of data that we've produced over the last several years, and we thought that an important question, considering that cities are increasingly focused on becoming more resilient. A lot of work is going into assessing the impacts of temperatures. Not that much work is going into trying to quantify what will happen with precipitation within urban environments. So it's a really important research gap that we identified and tried to examine in detail.
Yes, you led a study about the urban heat island effect in 2014 in Pinas, and you found cities will rise 1 to 2 degrees C above and separate from greenhouse warming expected globally. That's a lot of extra heat. Where does it come from?
So urban areas add heat to their regional environment, their local and regional environment, really two general ways. First, it's just the transition from a previous land cover that includes vegetation to a land cover that really doesn't include any vegetation. It's devoid of vegetation. And the lack of vegetation means that the evapotranspiring potential of plants and gardens and trees and so on and so forth, that's gone. So that's an immediate warming effect. Second, or I should say related to this, is the fact that urban areas are sinks of energy. They absorb incoming solar radiation, and by virtue of them being tall, you have these tall buildings, the morphological characteristics and the distribution of these buildings, it prevents cities from cooling in the evening and nighttime hours. So emitted radiation during the evening nighttime hours is actually kept within the urban canopy. This is the principal reason behind cities being warmer than their rural areas. Another important consideration that has to be mentioned is the way we, and when I say we, I mean us as in the humans, the way we utilize energy. For example, the utility of air conditioners, by virtue of the way they work, we take energy from inside our built environments and we dump it into the ambient outdoor environment. So we're adding extra heat. Our transportation sector, we're adding extra heat. And so these are really the broad ways in which humans, in which cities, which are built by humans, modify the thermal characteristics of their regional area.
And your new paper, published in Environmental Research Letters, finds a second major impact of big human development, changes to precipitation. The odds of extreme precipitation and urban flooding are increasing. Please explain how cities could do that.
Yeah, to be completely clear, it's been well known for several decades that cities can impact precipitation. They can either increase precipitation or decrease precipitation. Some of the earliest observational studies in the early 1970s really shed light on the potential mechanisms that are responsible for this. What we do in this paper is try to characterize the effect of both climate change, the increase in greenhouse gases, simultaneously with urban growth. That had not been done before. So that's the new element that we bring to this new research, which is important because for policymakers and planners and citizenry alike, everybody is interested in what the future climate might be, not just due to urban development and not just to greenhouse gas-induced climate change. People live in cities, and so they're interested to know how the built infrastructure, in addition to greenhouse gases, might affect precipitation. The principal mechanisms behind this from an urban perspective are there's a couple of physical mechanisms. One of them has to do with the urban heat island effect that we discussed a few minutes ago. And in general, cities are warmer than their rural environments, and this warm air has a tendency to rise over cities. And so this rising air provides essentially more energy to precipitating systems, thereby increasing their efficiency, leading to more precipitation.
How do you define extreme precipitation, and do we have data showing it is already increasing in American cities?
So there isn't one data-driven definition of extreme precipitation. It kind of depends on what metric that you want to use, and we didn't stick to one metric because that varies from city to city. And so we looked at different indices of extreme precipitation. We looked at the 99th percentile of contemporary climate precipitation, which is essentially equivalent to the four wettest days out of the year, or the 95th percentile of contemporary precipitation, which is essentially equivalent to about the 19 or 20 wettest days of the year, and similarly for the 90th percentile. So we looked at each one of these different metrics to try to get a sense for the exceedance of these absolute values under a future climate that is also characterized by urban development. To answer your second question, yes, there is actually evidence of increased precipitation. If we're looking at previous data, extreme one-day precipitation events have been increasing. Basically, the land area that's covered as a result of these one-day precipitation events across the contiguous United States has nearly doubled during the previous century. But we need information not just on what's happened in the past. We need information on what's going to happen in the future. This is particularly important for still developing cities. Phoenix is, as of today, the fifth largest city in the United States, still growing very rapidly. Many cities in the western United States continue to grow considerably. And so they're thinking, their policymakers, citizenry, stakeholders are thinking about not just extreme heat, but extreme precipitation.
Can you give us any example of a large city flooding where the excess precipitation, it may be partly the result of the built environment itself?
First of all, I should say that there's many such examples. One example that comes to my mind is a little bit older, perhaps. It dates back to 2008 and 2009 in Atlanta. There was a precipitation event that stalled over the Atlanta metro region for several days and resulted, if I recall correctly, in not just a few inches of rain across the metro area, but I think up to a couple of feet of rainfall. It inundated the entire city. Closer to home here in Phoenix, I believe it was in 2013, Sky Harbor International Airport which is the one central location where precipitation measurements are kept. There are others, but it is the standard National Weather Service site. I believe they received something like 3.5 inches in a six-hour period, so a very short period of time. The result of that was that all of the interstates were underwater, completely flooded, and cars were submerged. Everything was at a complete standstill. So this is happening more and more frequently across urban areas, not just in Atlanta, not just in Phoenix. We can think of tropical systems as well. For example, the situation in Texas with Hurricane Harvey a couple of years ago, and part of the reason why that situation became so deleterious was because of the increase in impervious fraction. That water falls and it can't percolate into the underlying soil, and so it just accumulates. And so stormwater management becomes a very important consideration in terms of adapting future cities to the increased frequency and intensity of these precipitating events.
So is the process of increased urban flooding in your study different from the large regional events like the massive floods happening as we speak in New South Wales, Australia?
Unfortunately, I'm not familiar with the massive flooding events happening in Australia, so I can't speak to that. But I can speak to the particular study that we undertook. So we conducted what are referred to as regional climate modeling simulations, which are a mechanistic, a process-based way of taking into account the evolution of the atmosphere and its interaction with the land surface. So we account for things like temperature changes due to greenhouse gas-induced climate change. We account for things like urban development, how cities grow. And we account for the interaction between these two important elements. And this is really the innovation behind our work. It is not just that it will rain more, but it will rain more because of these two forcing agents that are interacting at disparate spatial scales. The effect of greenhouse gas-induced climate change is certainly global, but if you tell the mayor of a particular city that average global precipitation by the end of the century will be X percent greater, that provides little decision-making information for that particular policymaker. We need place-based information for cities across the world, including Australia, especially cities that are continuing to urbanize, where the complexities of these two processes are particularly unknown, and the interrelationships between these two processes are particularly unknown.
And a lot of your work looks forward to a future where cities continue to grow. Are we sure that's going to happen? I mean, maybe this pandemic signals a shift away from dense populations towards more distributed setups for people working online. What do you think?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And I think many of us have thought about what is the future workplace environment and what this means for social interaction. And I tend to believe the exact opposite. I tend to believe that once the pandemic is officially in terms of actual health statistics and CDC guidelines and the appropriate WHO suggestions, once it's officially behind us, I think there's going to be such a strong impulse for folk to get back together. We are a social species. We interact, we innovate, we evolve together, not in solitary confinements. So I think if anything else, this will spur innovation to build cities, perhaps including options for decreasing density. But for the most part, I think density is a thing of the future as a result of the social system that we are.
Does your study presuppose Western-style city expansion from a dense urban core through suburbs, or would the same effects on climate be expected, for example, in cities in Africa or South America, where you might have slums and much less planning?
No, that's a very good question. And so our urbanization development trajectories are guided by data that was produced by the Environmental Protection Agency. But that's a very important parameter that goes into our modeling effort. And so the actual specific horizontal and vertical extent or lack of vertical extent of cities is an important driver in modulating precipitation effects. And so it's possible that over some regions, the urban-induced signal will be greater. And it's possible that in other regions, the greenhouse gas-induced signal will completely dominate. In fact, what we've seen here is that there is an urban-induced signal, but the greenhouse gas-induced signal still plays a very important role, a greater role than the urban-induced signal. But the pattern of urbanization, the pattern of the transportation sector, type of cars that are used, the fuel efficiency, the building infrastructure, type of electricity, and do we turn our thermostat up a degree or down a degree? All of these are important elements that constitute the built environment, and together they shape the impact of the built environment on not just temperature, but precipitation and hydroclimate in general, environmental consequences as a result of the built environment.
I would think the insurance industry has noticed an increase in claims from flood damages in cities. Have you heard anything about that?
It's not really within my particular area of expertise, so I can't make any intelligent comment on that, unfortunately. But it would not surprise me if that's the case. The United States, for example, is 85% urban, and so the majority of people live in urban areas. There's an increased frequency and intensity of urban flooding, and the destruction of property is obviously an important, in addition to the loss of life, obviously has a monetary value that the insurance industry has to be aware of.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest from Arizona State University, Dr. Matei Georgescu. And we're talking about unique science showing cities may increase their own extreme precipitation events. And I find that your study connects with a new developing theme. We started out with global climate models, and the grid scale was very, very large. Cities couldn't be seen in them. And then I started seeing about 10 years ago more and more regional climate predictions. And now, finally, we're getting to the mega city level. I talked with Dr. Lei Zhao about his work on this, and he found possibly cities could raise 4 degrees or more Fahrenheit in the coming century. How does that fit in with your work?
So those results are very much in line with some results that we published in 2018 focused on continental United States cities, and so they're in agreement with those results. I think much of his work really adds to the foundation and depth of knowledge for cities outside of the United States, in particular cities across Africa and cities across Asia. And it really underscores the importance of repeating what we've done here for the United States globally, right? What is the trajectory of urban development? You brought up the issue of Africa earlier. What is the trajectory of urban development, be it more horizontally spread or maybe horizontally and vertically spread, low density, high density? Now is an opportune time for the scientific community, together with policymakers, together with architects, together with the insurance industry, to get together and to try to imagine what is the definition of a resilient city. I don't think that the scientific community knows what that is, because the scientific community needs to be in contact with people on the ground. If the scientific community indicates that a particular city will be warmer by 3 or 4 degrees Celsius by mid or the end of the century, that in and of itself is not useful information. What's useful information is what is the impact of that thermal change for people and their livelihood? What is the impact in terms of health outcomes? What is the impact in terms of the energy bill? What is the impact in terms of infrastructure damage as relates to flooding or other natural hazards? And so what I think we're building towards is a more unifying, more cohesive focus on environmental impacts rather than just thermal impacts, and certainly trends in that direction.
And we're not alone here. The plants and animals are moving poleward due to global warming, and we're changing their habitats, often wiping them out. Do you think that cities can become more natural, more able to cohabit with the other species?
I think that will be an essential component, is to bring back nature into cities. And some related work that we focused on, it was a different topic. It was focused on urban agriculture and potential co-benefits associated with adopting and deploying urban agriculture at scale globally within cities. I think really sheds light on the potential to essentially add to ecosystem services, both in the financial sense, but also in the life sense that you bring up, by continuously laying down this pavement of concrete across the entire globe, we're disrupting habitats in unknown ways. And it's really unfortunate because we don't know what the end result of this impact is. Simultaneously, humans need to get back in touch with nature. That is we are a social butterfly as a species, but the propensity, the need to get back in touch with nature is an undeniable, at least in my opinion, necessity for it's an essential component of what constitutes a resilient city.
I recently spoke with the director of the Tyndall Center, Dr. Robert Nichols, on Radio EcoShock, and he talked to us about sinking cities and the compaction of soils. And I have to think that the fact that we've withdrawn so much groundwater and tightened up those soils will also add to that urban flooding effect when the extreme precipitation events come.
No, that's a fantastic point. I've done some work over Mexico City, and I've actually, as part of that work, I've been there and I've seen it with my own eyes, where you have buildings and associated infrastructure now at an angle as a result of the massive urban development of what was previously Lake Texcoco in that part of Mexico. And it's just a shame. It's just a shame that this, for lack of a better word, unregulated urban development has happened without any sort of insight into what the potential impacts are. And although I mentioned Mexico City here, there are similar impacts across the planet. And I think what the scientific community is adding is essentially peeling the proverbial layers of the onion to better quantify the potential impacts, like we've done here by quantifying rainfall, greenhouse gas-induced interactions, or what Lay has done in trying to, with some of his most recent work, in trying to better understand how artificial intelligence can be used in lieu of these regional climate models, which are very expensive computationally to execute. So there needs to be some way from a data production perspective. You know, what is the stakeholder of today or of tomorrow going or expected to do, run these regional climate models over his or her own city? That is unfair expectation. So it's really an opportunity for the entire scientific community to kind of get together and ask the question, which begins with, what is the ideal city for our population, our geography, our socio-demographic distribution, and how do we expect to get there, right? So defining a timeline of how we expect to get to this particular endpoint. This particular endpoint will vary with place, obviously, because different places have different expectations, different norms, different values, different belief systems. But the time is right for the scientific community. We're doing a lot of that at Arizona State University, where we're getting out of our so-called ivory towers, where we're working with policymakers, we're working with stakeholders, because we're interested in what their questions are. We're not doing research for the sake of just doing research, but we're trying to do research that matters to people on the ground and that matters to cities of the future.
And you've said that excess heat from cities will become a factor in overall global warming. Is this reflected in the work of the IPCC? Will the new AR6 report have something on this, or is this kind of cutting edge and it's not being employed enough yet?
It certainly has not been employed. Through AR5, this has not been a consideration, and it's unfortunate for me to say that most of the work of the urban climate community has been deemed as a round-off error by the global climate modeling community, and that's just an undeniable fact. AR6 will take an important step in trying to incorporate urban environments, and I think that there's this increasing realization across the scientific community that urban areas matter. The thermal impact of urban areas globally averaged is indeed a round-off error. That is also undeniable. But for the farmer that lives in the Midwestern United States, providing information that the globe will be 5 degrees Celsius warmer by the end of the century is useless when it comes to cropping patterns or changes associated with cropping patterns that particular farmer needs to make, or that the mayor in Adelaide, Australia, needs to make in regards to what sort of energy investments need to be made, which depend on traffic patterns, which depend on urban development, and so on and so forth. And so AR6 will take an important step in that direction. I very much look forward to what this means more explicitly and in greater detail.
Well, I mentioned in the opening, and I'm wondering if it is correct to say that our massive cities with millions of people are generating their own weather patterns and impacting the climate as a whole.
Can you clarify what that means? Are you referring to just people themselves?
No, I'm talking about the way that we live, our overall structures, our transportation systems that you've been talking about. Are we really generating, in part, our own weather systems, as fires do?
So it's a little bit more difficult to say that we're generating our own weather systems, although there is evidence of modification of existing weather systems. So, for example, there's plenty of satellite data, and there's been a lot of work by, you know, Marshall Shepard and many others that have shown, Robert Bornstein, shown classical urban-induced signatures. So you can see a particular thunderstorm that is moving to the southeast towards New York City. And New York City has a very extensive skyline, and the thunderstorm splits in two as it moves across the skyline. So the city itself winds up getting no actual rain, but now locations outside of the city wind up getting rain as a result of the vertical extent of the city. So to suggest that the built environment itself is impacting local to regional scale climate, not just temperature, which I think is very well accepted now, but precipitation, I think that's very evident, and the data certainly shows that.
When it comes to urban flooding, if we go on with business as usual, what do you expect as the decades progress?
I expect cities to essentially have to deal with a lot more flooding issues in the future, similar situations to what we saw across Texas a couple of years ago. Of course, these will vary because the storm systems that Texas receives are not the same storm systems that, for example, Arizona might receive. But each city has its own particular resilience to individual flooding events, and an extreme precipitation event across one geography is going to be different across a different geography, much in the same way as a summer daytime temperature of 40 degrees in Phoenix is actually not a warm day, but a 40 degree Celsius day in New York City is an abhorrently hot day, right? So it's all relative, so it matters. Geography is very important. But if cities do not include modifications to their urban infrastructure, incorporation of parks, for example, a decrease in impervious fraction, improved water management, diversion of water, or perhaps incorporation of additional techniques like permeable surfaces, parking surfaces that are spread all over cities that simply run off water once the sewers are filled, as they were in the 2013 floods of Phoenix, Arizona. Once those sewers fill, water has nowhere to go but up, right? So incorporating new techniques like permeable surfaces, for example, which maintains this hydrological connectivity, that water can then evaporate back into the surface and is maintained as part of the natural hydrologic cycle, is something that collectively we as a community, including the scientific community, are going to have to consider very carefully, unless we want to deal with the repercussions of increased flooding, perhaps to the extent that we haven't seen before.
Well, you've given us some important information here. We've been speaking with Dr. Matei Georgescu from the University of Arizona, and he's the lead author of the paper. The title is Precipitation Response to Climate Change and Urban Development Over the Continental United States. You can find links to that science in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Matei, your work really is stimulating. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you very much, Alex, for having me on, and thank you very much for your interest in our work. It's been a great pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.